Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. This is yet another day in which we have far more to talk about than we will ever get into the about 1 hour that we have on the air here, including some very important breaking news we'll get to in a minute. But first, let me introduce the panel. Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him in the paper virtually every day. You see his byline attached to lots of stories, and he also contributes to the Political Insider blog, part of Politically Georgia, at the MyAJC website. Hey, Greg, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Patricia Murphy is also back with us. It's been a while, and we're really glad you're back, Patricia.
I'm really glad I'm back, too.
Patricia writes for, columns for, Roll Call, The Daily Beast. You're now writing for Garden and Gun, which is really cool.
Thank you. Thank you. I just try and keep busy.
We're not going to be able to afford you pretty soon, Patricia. And I saved for last a brand new member of our panel who we're so happy to have here. He is the newly installed mayor of Loganville, Mayor Ray Martinez. You've been on the job for, what, 2 weeks?
2 weeks, yes.
And you were elected in the November. I assume you were on the ballot in November. Is that correct?
I was on the ballot in November, yes.
Did you crush your opponent? What was that race like?
How about 68 to 32? So that's a landslide. as the Gwinnett Daily Post said, it was a landslide.
So just to give people a little better sense of you, although the mayor's office and the race leading to it is nonpartisan, you are a proud Republican, yes?
Yes, I am.
Been involved with Republican Party politics or candidates for a while now?
For a long time. I remember my first vote was George Herbert Walker Bush back in the late 90s, and I supported Bob Dole and so on and so forth, yes.
Okay, well, welcome. We're glad to have you here, Mayor Martinez. Let's get to a couple of breaking stories. One we'll just mention because it's getting a lot of attention from other sources. Republican members of Congress are on their way to White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, to the Greenbrier Resort, where they hold their annual retreats. And by now you probably know that the train they were on was in an accident with a
garbage truck.
One person in the garbage truck. There were three people in the truck. One was killed. One was medevaced to a hospital, and we don't know his condition. We're told so far, Patricia, that there have been no serious injuries among members of Congress. Some are now saying they've got complaints, maybe concussion, maybe whiplash, that sort of thing.
Yes, I think no serious injuries among members of Congress reported so far, but I think it certainly has made it a very difficult way to start what was supposed to be a relatively routine and celebratory retreat of House Republicans. Mike Pence was supposed to be with them later this afternoon.
And President Trump is supposed to be with them tomorrow.
So it puts it all up in the air. They intend to continue, but it certainly is a very, just another really strange thing for House Republicans. They keep having these very strange, tragic events just surrounding the work that they're doing
now. They were being transported back to Charlottesville and get on a bus for White Sulphur Springs. Speaker Ryan was on that train. Mm-hmm. And there are some questions as to how they proceed, given that there was a fatality in this wreck. I think they're trying to feel their way through what they do next.
Yeah, it's a tough issue. And we started getting texts from aides to the Georgia delegation saying that they're okay. And we hadn't even heard of what it is they're okay about, you know, what had happened yet. And within minutes, we saw the news about that wreck. So glad that there were only limited injuries, at least for the people on the train.
Yeah, well, we'll keep track of how that develops. One other piece of breaking news. We've got another Republican leader in the House who said he's not going to run for re-election, Trey Gowdy, who is chair of the House Oversight Committee. People remember him across the country. Mostly because he led the Benghazi investigation on his committee. He's always wanted, apparently, to be a judge. And so we're not surprised that he has really decided not to run for re-election. I don't think Democrats can take any joy and say, oh, here's another Republican who's nervous about re-election.
Yeah, because he's not. I mean, this is a safe Republican district.
In South Carolina.
Sort of upstate South Carolina.
Yeah, Greenville, Spartanburg area. And Trey Gowdy was first elected in 2010. And in my coverage of Congress, every cycle people would say, do you think Gowdy's going to run again? He was somebody who didn't seem to take a lot of joy in the job. He certainly had a lot of friends. He was very well liked. But as a former prosecutor, he's somebody who is quite prosecutorial and really chafed at the confines, I think the political confines of the job. And he said in his statement today that he would like to return to the justice system. Yeah. There's a vacancy on the federal appeals court there. So that might be his not so subtle signal if he's available.
Mayor, although Trey Gowdy's not an example of a Republican who was worried about re-election, as you see all of these resignations of incumbents, members, does it give you pause as a Republican about how easy it's or how difficult it's going to be to retain control of the House in November?
Well, I think it's going to be pretty easy for the Republicans to maintain control.
You do? Okay.
Trey Gowdy's in a safe district, as Greg mentioned. Maybe he's got future, you know, maybe, I'm just saying, maybe AG, Attorney General, who knows?
Yeah.
But
wow.
But, you know, you never know. You never know. You know, I'm sure if the Commander-in-Chief comes calling you, you go with it.
All right.
But I tell you, it's going to be a very interesting year. What our president did yesterday with the State of the Union, in my opinion, helped out the Republican cause. He did lay out a lot of achievements, and that's what the State of the Union is all about, the State of the Union. And he made a very compelling statement about what his first year in term has been.
I'll tell you what, I'm glad you mentioned the State of the Union. We're certainly going to talk a lot about it in the next few minutes. But before we get to that, there really is an enormously important breaking story that hits hard right here in Georgia. Greg, we learned this morning that Brenda Fitzgerald, who had been appointed director of the Centers for Disease Control this past summer, was basically forced out. And when you see the reason that she was forced out, it's a little bit breathtaking, isn't it?
Yeah, and of course, she was Georgia's former health commissioner. So she had a long stint as the top doctor, medical doctor in Georgia, essentially. And she was forced out because of troubling financial investments in tobacco and healthcare companies that posed potential conflicts of interest. Some of these were uncovered this week by Politico, and it was very swift. It was within a day or two of the first reports that she was forced to resign.
The reason I said breathtaking, Patricia, is here's the director of CDC leading an agency who has always identified smoking as one of the nation's greatest health crises, and she's investing in the Japan Tobacco Company, which in Japan, in Asia, represents some of the largest tobacco brands in the United States.
Yes, and you know she has already run into some trouble on the Hill earlier this year and in the fall. There were several hearings that she could not testify to as the head of the CDC because of her financial conflicts that existed because of the holdings that she already had coming into it. And it was big things like the opioid crisis, medical health records, because she had these financial holdings. And Republicans are like, we need you to divest. We need you to sell. And then to learn that she has then been acquiring more financial interests that posed further conflicts, I think that was really the straw that broke the camel's back. She literally was not able to do her job at a certain point.
Ray, the timing of this is pretty interesting. First of all, she was appointed by Tom Price before he had to step down as HHS secretary. Price's successor, Alex Azar, was just sworn in, I believe, on Monday of this week. 2 days later, Brenda Fitzgerald is out.
Absolutely, and I'm glad that it came about so swiftly, and I'm glad that it took what about a day and a half before the news came out for her to resign, and that's the way it should be, and I'm glad that we're just going to move forward on this event.
So Greg, we don't have exactly a great record in terms of Trump appointments from Georgia.
Well, we have the we had the designated survivor last night, Sonny Perdue.
He did a great job.
And we have Chris Wray as the FBI head.
Yeah.
And some and there's of course like sort of lower level Georgians all over the White House. But yeah, these are two high profile resignations, both linked to each other, of course, because as you mentioned, Price appointed Dr. Fitzgerald.
So I don't think most people know. excuse me, when you talk about the designated survivor. One member of the president's cabinet is always told he or she cannot attend the State of the Union address because the line of succession has to be maintained. And if there is some terrible event at the Capitol, you've got to have somebody ready to fill the president's shoes.
Yes, and it was Sonny Perdue. And as a hunter and fisher, we were saying last night he could probably literally survive anything. So he was a good choice, and he apparently survived, so he did it.
I think AJC pointed out that he doesn't even look a little bit like Keanu Reeves, who plays this designated survivor. I mean, Kiefer Sutherland.
Yeah.
Tom Faust reminds me it's Kiefer Sutherland, who plays the part of a designated survivor thrust into the presidency on a TV series, a network TV series.
A TV series my wife likes and that I have not really gotten into yet.
Haven't seen it. That's why I didn't know it wasn't Keanu Reeves. All right, so it'll be interesting to see what they do with CDCs, Greg, because clearly an agency of such crucial importance to the country.
Yeah, and remember, this is right in the middle of the nation's biggest flu epidemic in decades. And as Patricia noted, for months now, Dr. Fitzgerald was sort of restricted from testifying on some of the other giant, like cancer, tobacco, smoking, opioids, because of her financial interest. And she signed an ethics agreement back in September to divest from those, but it just proved a little harder to disentangle herself from those investments, as we saw today.
So, Ray, let me ask you. You've got Brenda Fitzgerald sort of representing a trait that seems to be fairly common in the Trump White House. Appointees who have deep financial interests in a variety of commercial business enterprises, for the most part, I mean, we pay attention to them, we note them, and for the most part, they seem to survive in their jobs. We haven't seen the kind of dramatic conflict that Brenda Fitzgerald represents, but is this the president reaping what he's sown in terms of appointing people with these kinds of financial interests, ongoing financial interests?
I just hope that from now on, the president's staff would do more of a research on these candidates, and that's my hope. You know, they found something on Ms. Fitzgerald. There and she's gone within days, and that's the way it should be. But my hope is moving forward. I hope these nominations are well vetted, and I hope they do more research on the future candidates.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, there's a president that apparently has a few financial conflicts as well. I think it's more she literally could not do the job. She was blacked out from large swaths of her responsibilities because of those financial ties. And you know, we've seen Steve Mnuchin coming out of Goldman Sachs. There are lots of very wealthy people with financial interests in the areas that they regulate, but hers was really one of the ones that was literally making it impossible. If you're not going to sell your stuff, certainly don't buy some more. And I think that really actually damaged the trust of the committee chairman as well, saying you're not actually even trying. So I think she's almost an outlier among a whole host of secretaries and officials who have numerous financial conflicts, but hers was particularly egregious, I think.
Well, the old-timers in the room, and I guess I am the only one, remember Brenda Fitzgerald's first appearance on the public stage was a candidate for Congress when you were just a little boy.
But she's close with former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. She's close with Sonny Perdue. She's obviously close with Tom Price. So she has a very deep roots in Republican politics in Georgia.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens next. She certainly has a great portfolio. I don't think she's going to worry about making a living. I'll tell you what. Let's do this. We want to turn to the State of the Union. But why don't we do this? Why don't we get our first break out of the way? And when we come back, we have a number of Georgians responding to the president's speech last night. Everybody on this panel is going to have something to say about it. So let's take a break and come back in just a moment. This is Political Rewind.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Joining us today, the newly installed mayor of Loganville, Republican Ray Martinez. Patricia Murphy writes for her columns at Mirror and Roll Call, Daily Beast. She now writes for Garden and Gun. And we always want to point out that you spent a good amount of your earlier career on the Hill working for Max Cleland. So you know Capitol Hill well.
Mm-hmm. And Sam Nunn.
Sam Nunn,
yep.
Before that.
And another senator, Senator Richard Bryan. So 9 years in the Senate before all of this.
Wow.
And I'm only 17.
That's right. And Greg Bluestein of the AJC joins us, too. The president gave his State of the Union last night. It was a long speech, 85-plus minutes. They would say a lot of that was consumed by all of the applause from Republicans. And there was a lot. The Republicans gave him quite an ovation. Let's just listen to a couple of things the president had to say, and then we'll talk about it. So here's the president talking about, really, this was kind of the theme for the entire speech.
This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream. So to every citizen watching at home tonight, no matter where you've been or where you've come from, this is your time. If you work hard, if you believe in yourself, if you believe in America, then you can dream anything. You can be anything. And together, we can achieve absolutely anything.
Greg, we spend so much time, or probably more than all of us need to, talking about the Twitter Trump, the teleprompter Trump. We thought back to the inaugural speech last year, which was dark and gloomy. But apparently Stephen Miller, who wrote the inaugural speech and put all of those dark themes into that, had a hand in writing this speech, an entirely different approach.
Different tone. I mean, last year, remember, there was talk of American carnage. And this is now America. That's what he used.
Yeah.
This is now the America's moment. It was largely devoid of nationalistic talk. There was talk here and there about reworking trade treaties, but nothing specific about NAFTA. There's talk about bipartisanship and the need to work together on infrastructure and immigration, but no very, very sharp overt political attacks that I could really pick up on, and largely devoid of confrontational tones. There's a few messages and symbolism he had that was confrontational, but I didn't see him be head-on collision confrontational.
Mayor, you've already said to us that you really liked what you heard last night. There are those who were looking, some in the base, who may have been looking for a little bit more red meat, who may have wanted to see the more confrontational Donald Trump. How do you weigh that impulse against this speech last night in which he at least tried to reach out in some ways?
Absolutely. As a nonpartisan mayor, my main objective is the betterment of Loganville. I tell you, as a blue-collar Hispanic mayor, these African-American, Hispanic, Hispanic unemployment rates are at an all-time low. That is breathtaking for the Hispanic population, and I'm speaking for them as a Hispanic official here in Loganville. As a mayor, what he said about streamlining permitting and approval for processing from the way it's been to 2 to 1 year, I tell you, that is music to my ears, because there's been times as a city mayor that I've said, you know what, we need to get this road fixed. And all the red tape for permitting is what's frustrating for my citizens and what's frustrating for me. But I'll tell you, as a blue-collar Hispanic It is breathtaking to my ears what's going on. The 401k, the stock market has gone up under this administration. So, and the tax reform has really helped out a lot of families, whether you're Hispanic, African-American. If you are a married couple, your first $24,000 are tax-free. That is breathtaking for the Hispanic population.
Patricia, almost every State of the Union, and you've seen a lot of them like I have, is filled with hyperbole, boasts that are not necessarily backed up by fact. Was there anything exceptionally different about Trump? We tend to judge him so much on what he's led us to understand, that he often exaggerates, doesn't tell the truth. So how did you look at the speech last night in that respect?
Well, you know, I thought it was so different from a typical State of the Union because most presidents are so policy-driven. Mm-hmm. They come out with an entire grocery list of, I'm going to do this and this and this and this and this and this and this. This president really doesn't, and is not a criticism, he just doesn't care about policy that much. I think he's much more into personalities and achievements and drama. And I think that he really, this reflected that in a way that I thought was strategically very smart. And to the extent that his speech writing team had to rein themselves in from what they really wanted to say, you know, this was heavy on people and heroes and personalities and stories. And even, and Donald Trump has always been a great storyteller. And I thought this really put that strength forward. He left all of the almost all the controversial stuff. We didn't hear about Rocket Man. We didn't hear about his most, you know, on Twitter, obviously he'll go after half the people in that room. That's why Nancy Pelosi wasn't clapping. That's why half, you know, many congressional Black Caucus members weren't theirs, because he's personally attacked them. But here he took it out of politics and put a shine on the American people. And I just thought it was really, really smart.
Well, we should point out there was politics in that speech. You're right. He did try to avoid a lot of it. He did talk about repealing the disastrous core of Obamacare, the individual mandate. He said, "We proudly stand for the national anthem," clearly
yes,
a reference
he
to
certainly
the
did.
NFL. He talked about naming judges who, quote, interpret the Constitution as written. So while I agree with you, he certainly got in his shots. And what I'd love to do is let's listen to him talking essentially about this proposal, this immigration reform plan,
yes,
which he's going to, we assume, push on the Hill. Let's listen.
"Tonight, I am extending an open hand to work with members of both parties, Democrats and Republicans, to protect our citizens of every background, color, religion, and creed. My duty, and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber, is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream. Because Americans are dreamers too."
Greg, what'd you make of that?
Americans are dreamers too.
Yeah.
I mean, that was about as confrontational as he got when it came to that immigration policy. And this is going to be the primary test for bipartisanship in Trump's second year, is whether or not you heard him call for a broader immigration overhaul that also includes domestic legal immigration, and what he calls chain migration. Senate Democrats and I think Democrats as large as a caucus want a much more limited act that also just deals with Dreamers and maybe border security, but not the legal immigration part. This might be the primary test for whether Democrats and Republicans can come together on this issue.
Mayor, what's the Hispanic population of Loganville?
We're about 2%.
Okay, so
it's
small.
Very small.
But nevertheless, you're in touch with it. I think you probably have your ear to the ground in the Hispanic community in many people do not. The president hasn't been enormously popular with Hispanics, largely because of some of the derogatory, offensive things he's said about people of Mexico.
Yes.
He's clearly decided that he wants to reduce undocumented residents in this country. So what do you hear when you hear him talking about Americans are dreamers, too?
Exactly. In 2016, I heard that the Hispanic population, as Greg knows, because he did cover my Cobb County event when Pence was here, I didn't talk about so much immigration. What I talked about, what's important for the Hispanic population. I'm a blue collar guy. What the Hispanics
want. What do you mean
when
you say you're a blue collar?
I'm a worker.
Okay.
I'm a worker.
Go ahead.
I'm mayor of a city. But I'm in the trenches with a Hispanic, and I understand them. I speak their language, and I understand exactly what they're looking for. We go to church on Sundays. We're a pro-family, and all we want to do is you give me a job, and we want money in our pockets. And I believe what this president has done, okay, what he's done, he's created 2.4 million new jobs since he's been elected. That's music to our ears from the Hispanic population.
Well,
again,
we should point, thank you for that. At the same time, we do have to point out that the fact checkers took more issue with the president taking credit for job growth than almost any other parts of his speech last night. Much of this job growth was well in progress before he took office, yes?
Yes. Well, I think that presidents probably get too much blame when the economy is bad too much credit when the economy is good. I think obviously the tax cuts, certainly for a particularly repatriation of offshore profits, has been a huge boon to corporate bottom lines. I think we can all say that. But I think when we heard him talking about immigration last night, I think what was so offensive to so many Democrats was that he introduced it with a conversation about gang activity and murders was his entree into a discussion about immigration. Certainly for the immigration hardliners on the right, that's their view of immigration. But for anybody who's looking to have a comprehensive immigration reform proposal, that was not the conversation they wanted to start off on. And I think Democrats have largely stopped listening to this president on immigration because they don't trust him when they walk out of the room. They're like, that was such a nice thing for you to hear. I know in two hours you're going to think something different. So he's got a lot of legwork to do, not so much words to say when it comes
Mayor,
to immigration.
Mayor, any response to
yes,
that?
Yes. First of all, as mayor of the city, I am going to tell you, I see it every day. Last year, we had over 185 house permits. Those are jobs in my community. Those are jobs in my county. This year, we're expecting over 200 house permits. In 2014 and 2011, those were not there. So now jobs are coming back to Loganville. I see it every day as mayor. I'm in the trenches out there. So I'm out there, and my as mayor of Loganville, I could speak for Loganville. My major is to keep my citizens safe.
Yeah,
that is my priority.
Greg,
and Trump's also facing what could be a conservative backlash over his willingness to negotiate on the future of
1.8 million people. He says he'll put on a path to citizenship.
Yeah, that's nearly 2 million people, and we're already seeing from conservative leaders, not just in Georgia but all over the nation, equating that to amnesty and a broken promise.
Yeah, they don't want a path to anything. Path to citizenship is a non-starter for them.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Patricia. All right, here, let me throw out to all three of you and ask you to respond to this. In addition to the specifics that we can talk about of what he had to say, I had a bigger, but a broader takeaway. I was looking at this from a 10,000-foot level, I guess. And I found it really distressing on this basis. We saw last night unequivocal visual proof of just how divided this Congress is. Democrats sat, they were criticized for not applauding, and Nancy Pelosi criticized for not applauding at moments that in which he was saying something that all Americans might applaud. Republicans cheered Trump enthusiastically over and over again. I mean, we've seen divided State of the Union addresses in the past, but I thought last night it was more demonstrable than almost any that I can recall. And the other quick thing, and then I'll throw it out to all of you, is last night, if there was any remaining doubt, last night we really saw evidence that Republicans have bought Trump hook, line, and sinker.
there were, when he was leaving the chamber, there were literally Republicans saying, "We've got your back." You know, and this is while all of this kind of Russian meddling investigations are going on, this huge controversy in the House Intelligence Committee, and for House members to literally be patting him on the back, you're like, "We got you, we got you." You know, I think that, and I think it's actually for him very important affirmation that he wants to hear affirmatively. I think I have seen this Congress equally divided. When President Obama was there and Joe Wilson said,
"You
lie,"
yeah, you're right.
It sort of was the lowest moment of division. Here, I think the Democrats literally believe it is in their best interest to oppose this president, that they will win elections if they oppose him. Not only do they morally oppose him, they disagree with him on most policies. They don't trust him, but I think they actually see it to their benefit to oppose him.
And by the way,
why they're acting this way.
And House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi had to caution her caucus not to have a "you lie" moment. She said, "If you're going to misbehave, if you're going to walk out, go ahead and stay out.
Just
don't come in."
Yeah. Let's listen to what some of our legislators here at downtown under the Gold Dome, where they're meeting in session right now, had to say. You're going to hear comments first from Fran Miller, and then from Josh McCoon, and you'll just listen as we get response from legislators.
I personally am pleased with most of his policies. I don't approve of some of his behavior, but that's okay. That's his business, I guess. And so anyway, I think overall I probably would get high marks.
Senator McCoon, what was your reaction to the State of the Union address by President Trump last night?
I thought the themes of the speech were, you know, broadly pro-American, and I think that that's why you saw even among some of the instant polls that were done, there were some Democrats that were saying, yeah, we like what we're hearing.
Representative Thomas, did you watch the State of the Union, and if so, what was your reaction?
I did not watch the State of the Union.
Why not?
Because I've heard enough from President Donald J. Trump. I've heard enough from him all year. I didn't want to see a wrap-up of all the rhetoric that he's been using throughout his first year as our president. So I definitely was looking to things and how I could better help my district. I thought that was way more important than watching him.
That was, by the way, GPB's lawmakers, reporter Lisa Raham, talking first to Republicans Fran Miller and Josh McCoon, and then finally to Democrat Erica Thomas. Have you been down to the Capitol today?
Yeah, I was there this morning. And those first two Republicans, they're such an interesting dichotomy because Fran Miller is a Dunwoody Republican who represents a district that went about 55% for Hillary Clinton. So he's got to walk a more cautious line. He can't be never Trump. And he's not never. I think he generally does embrace Trump's policies. But the Trump is still deeply unpopular in his district, where Josh McCoon comes from a very conservative West Georgia district centered on the outskirts of Columbus, he can afford to be a little bit even more aggressively pro-Trump.
Okay. Patricia, let's talk briefly about the response from the Democrats. The official response was, it was by a guy with royalty in his blood.
Yes, Joe P. Kennedy III. I wrote a column about him for Roll Call before he spoke. He really is somebody who is, to borrow a very tired line, a rising star. But he also has, for Democrats, what they really need. He really catches on with the grassroots. He is unapologetically liberal. Went to Stanford, Harvard, and he's a Kennedy. I found it kind of a little cynical of Democratic leaders to put him in this very high-profile position because he's so junior. He's obviously not really going to challenge them for anything. It was just a way for them to get kind of some Kennedy glamour without a real challenge to their leadership.
Well,
and there's a lot of frustration among more junior Democrats with this current House leadership.
Can we also say that he injects something else in the Democratic Party that they desperately need? He's young.
Yes. He is 37.
We have all of these old people in the Democratic Party. We have Bernie Sanders. We have Joe Biden. You
Nancy
may
Pelosi.
Love them, Nancy Pelosi. But these folks, their day is soon coming to an end. A new generation had better step up.
Yeah, and the setting was very fitting. He had a car behind him that looked like it was recently worked on. I know a lot of the dialogue was over whether or not he had too much lip gloss on. But there was a room full of people who were enthusiastically applauding his speech. So it did kind of set off, not just from Democratic leadership, but also from President Trump, who is also in his 70s. So.
He was, by the way, he would tell you it wasn't lip gloss. It was chapstick. It wasn't as if
he was wearing
makeup. Let's listen to just a couple of remarks from Kennedy, and then I'm going to ask you to respond, Mayor.
Bullies may land a punch. They may leave a mark. But they have never, not once, in the history of our United States, managed to match the strength and spirit of a people united in defense of their future. Politicians can be cheered for the promises they make. Our country will be judged by the promises we keep. That is the measure of our character. That is who we are. Out of many, one.
Ray, the bully. Trump is going to be accused of being a bully for a long time, and it'll certainly be a word that we hear a lot in 2018. And, of course, he ends by talking about our character, who we are. We're out of many, one. That's a fairly resonant theme, is it not, for Democrats to run on in this election year?
No, it's not. Trump has kept his promises. He wanted to make, in 2016, he wanted to make America great again. Okay, you could interpret that any which way you want. But as a Hispanic, as a Hispanic American, when Apple invests $350 billion in this great country, Exxon Mobil just announced they're going to invest $50 billion in investments. That's making our country great again. Again, I speak as a blue collar Hispanic in the trenches, mayor of Loganville. Those are jobs in my community. That's going to help out everybody. So that's what he's trying to do. That's what this president is trying to do. And I am for Trump for those reasons. Okay, he wants to slash regulations. He wants to make businesses better, more faster to invest. So all those things are very important for just everybody.
Patricia?
Well, I think Americans are broadly satisfied with the economy, very obviously happy with the metrics that are going up. But there is a gap between not only the credit that they give the president, but also the amount that they're willing to give him because he is so divisive. And so I think if there was a way going forward, he could better approach the job that wasn't so broadly offensive to so many people, they would want to give him more credit, but they're not even giving him credit for what he probably should be able to get credit for because they don't like him as a person. And so I think he's got a lot of work to do between now and 2018.
I'm going to tell you, with all due respect, a Hispanic out there working in Loganville trying to build that house does not care if Trump is offensive. What they care about is, are you going to give me a job tomorrow? Am I going to come back to Loganville and build the next house?
Are you going to deport my grandma?
I get certainly you're making the argument Republicans will make. And the economy is strong. There are a lot of jobs out there. The question about whether wages are really on the rise is another question entirely. But I think we have to understand that given all the positive economic factors, this is a president who still has incredibly low approval ratings. And you do have to think that a lot of that is attributable to the way he behaves in office.
He had a 37% Gallup approval rating going into the speech, which was the lowest in the modern era going into a second year in presidency, State of the Union. But among Republicans, it remains in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And that just shows the gulf. Republicans stand by him, love him, embrace him. But independents and Democrats still have.
All right, I got to get another break in. Before I do, real quickly, Patricia, you've got about 20 seconds, 30 seconds. You've worked on the Hill. I think it'd be interesting how many Democrats think about focus grouping the word bully as it applies to Donald Trump. I think we're going to hear that word come up a lot in the campaign.
And I don't think you need to spend the money on the focus group
for
bully.
Right.
I mean, I think it does the work for you.
All right. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way. When we come back, yet another Atlantan, another Georgian, is in the news, FBI Director Christopher Wray. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret history of Israel's targeted assassination program. We talk with Ronan Bergman. His new book, Rise and Kill First, investigates the methods, morality, and motives behind such killings and the controversies surrounding them. Bergman is the defense correspondent for Israel's largest newspaper. Join us.
Fresh Air this afternoon at 3, here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Patricia, let me just say that I'm going to ask Olivia Rheingold and Tom Faust. You mentioned you've written a column in Roll Call about Joe Kennedy today. Can we post that? We're going to post a link to that on the Political Rewind
Thank
website,
gpbnews.org. To the traffic spike.
Chart beat.
Greg Bluestein. Christopher Wray is in the news today as FBI director, and it all relates to this memo. I think we're going to try to carve out some time. We're not going to have it today. On Friday's show, people hear a lot about this memo that Republicans are eager to release that allegedly shows that there was politics behind the, first of all, politics that stunted the investigation of Hillary Clinton and her emails, then that sparked the investigation of the Russia connection with President Trump. And apparently, Republicans are ready to release this thing, and the FBI director says it is dangerous to do so.
Yeah, this is quite the day for Georgians and high-ranking Trump administration or Washington positions. So this memo purports to show how the FBI and the Justice Department abused their authorities to obtain a warrant to spy on former Trump campaign advisor. And Christopher Wray, who is a former Atlanta attorney with King & Spalding and the U.S. Attorney's Office, is now the FBI director, and he clashed publicly with the White House for the and with President Trump for the first time since he was confirmed as the FBI director, essentially saying that the FBI didn't have time to vet this memo and that it should not be released.
Well, I think that it's so unusual. It's just one in a series of unusual events with all of this. So rare to see an FBI director come out and publicly contradict the White House. And it seems clear that he had given this opinion privately, and it was not listened to. And I think in talking to some of my sources within the FBI, I think the morale within the FBI right now is so damaged. They need to have somebody publicly standing up for them. And Chris Wray was really welcomed by this White House, sought out by this White House, and then to be coming into the crosshairs with them and becoming a part of a controversy, I think is also begins to make the work of the FBI on other issues much more difficult. And there's a concern even among moderate Republicans, that there's an effort to discredit the FBI as a whole in a way to protect the president. And that's very concerning.
So House Republicans say they want to release the memo. The White House is given 5 days under the law to decide whether or not they will approve the release of the memo. But last night, Mayor, the president was overheard as he left the chamber talking to a Republican member who urged him, you're going to get that memo out. And we overheard the president saying 100% it's coming out. Does this worry you at all?
It does worry me somewhat. The FBI should not be politicized, and it's out there. It's out there that for two years they've been after the administration. You know, it's funny because Trump asked the FBI who he voted for, and so it's a shame. And I'm glad that he stepped down. And I just want to start a new beginning. You know, I want the next FBI to be vetted. And it should be non-political. It should be a non-political post.
Do you think, in fact, though, that the president and some of the conservative Republicans on the Hill are mounting an unwarranted and dangerous attack on DOJ and FBI?
No, I don't think so.
Really? Okay. All right. Greg, final thing on this subject, Sally Yates. Tom Faust, our producer, pointed this out to me. She put out a tweet yesterday saying the U.S. has experienced relentless attacks, her words, on its institutions and norms. She's called on the country to live up to American values. Tom points out she sent out that tweet on the one-year anniversary of her being fired by President Trump from her job as acting AG.
And that was one other cloud. And, of course, that wasn't mentioned in the State of the Union, but no mention of Russia or interference. And there are very legitimate concerns that Russia is continuing to try to interfere with this year's midterm elections and politics at large here ongoing.
All right. Well, we know that this isn't coming to an end anytime soon. So let's take a look with a little time we have left at some developments in the governor's race, which is, of course, going to be the big, big ticket item in the months ahead as we move toward first May primaries and then the general election in November. Greg, first of all, Democrat Stacey Evans, in a fierce battle with Stacey Abrams to win the Democratic nomination, got an endorsement that I think it's fair to say is pretty significant.
Yeah, it's the Georgia Federation of Teachers. It's not the biggest educator group in Georgia, but it's something that I think she hopes will inoculate her from criticism that she's pro-voucher. And this group is very interesting because they broke very publicly with her opponent, Stacey Abrams, over the issue of the Opportunity School District, Governor Deal's failed 2014 initiative to give the state more power to take control of failing schools. Stacey Evans actually voted for that initiative. Stacey Abrams voted against it, but also failed to block it from getting to the House floor. So the group broke with Stacey Abrams over that. I asked yesterday, well, how do you reconcile that? You're supporting someone who voted for the proposal that you hate the most. And they said, essentially, we're looking forward. This is someone who we're willing to work with. And also Stacey Evans said she regretted that big vote for Opportunity School District back in.
Well, you can't underestimate the importance of teacher votes. Just ask Roy Barnes
in
his re-election campaign back in 2002.
Yes, oppose the teachers at your own peril. I think that is the lesson learned from that campaign. As Greg said, it's not the biggest union, it's not the only union, but you always want to have the teachers in your corner, for sure. And publicly opposing them, it can really yield disastrous consequences, even unintended consequences down the road.
At the same time, Stacey Abrams is, I think, in Washington today, where she's meeting, is it a fundraiser, Greg? What are they calling themselves?
A Thousand Women Strong, I think is what it was called.
Yeah.
But today is the deadline day for reporting for this next round of contributions. And this is a big deal because it shows, of course, money isn't everything. John Oxendine and John Ossoff know that pretty well. But it's a big show, not only for supporters who are already backing your camp, but shows how viable you are as a candidate. It shows other donors that, hey, this candidate is the right candidate to back. And it also shows early strength and organization for these candidates. I mean, the primary is less than 4 months away.
Yeah, so there are furious emails going out to potential donors from all of the campaigns saying midnight is the deadline. We need your support. Mayor, have you got a candidate in the Republican race yet?
I do. I'm a Brian Kemp guy.
Okay, well, good.
I'm a Brian Kemp guy.
That leads us into the conversation we ought to have.
Yes.
Cagle's already released his numbers for this reporting.
He has almost $7 million overall and close to $4 million from this last phase.
And Kemp has got to try to show, as for the reasons Greg points out, that he can be competitive. And so far, we'll see what happens, but he's not going to be close, probably. Is that an issue?
It looks like it's going to go for the runoff. It looks like definitely Cagle is the establishment. He's been around for a long time. But Brian Kemp is a workhorse. And as you guys have seen, money and establishment is not everything. It's how much you're willing to work out there. And it worked for my campaign. I actually ran against an established lady that was that's the wife of a former mayor. And look at me now. I got 68% versus 32. So it's not all money. It's how much you work. And
why
it looks like Brian Kemp is going to be
How did you choose Kemp? What was the decision based on?
Kemp has always been a loyal supporter of mine since I've been in the city council since 2010. We've got a good relationship with Kemp, and I look forward to all the things he's going to do.
Patricia, it is true that John Ossoff could tell you that raising a ton of dough isn't necessarily the way to win. On the other hand, right now, with the primary looming much more quickly than a lot of people realize, it's a couple months away. It's May. If Kemp, Michael Williams, I think I'm correct, has had to write his own campaign
about $1 million already.
$1 million to even show that he can be competitive. So how important is it going to be to see these financial disclosure figures?
Well, it's important for two reasons. First of all, it is sort of the culling of the herd in terms of who could actually mount a campaign. And then second of all, in that race for the number two slot, you've got to get your name ID up. Anybody besides Casey Cagle is basically unknown statewide. And so you've got to have the money to go up on the air. You've got to have some cash in the bank for that.
And the mayor is right. I mean, look, it's going to almost certainly be a runoff. And the big question is going to be whether it will be Brian Kemp at that slot. Maybe it could be Clay Tippins. We'll see about Hunter Hill or Michael Williams. But Cagle also might have a big decision to make, because if he sees his poll numbers edging toward the 40s, he could decide to go all in and try to get to 50 plus one, or he could just save and plan for the runoff. And the Democratic side is going to be really interesting too, because despite Stacey Abrams, you mentioned she's in Washington, she has a national profile and is a proven fundraiser, yet she only raised about $500,000 in that first, in that last reporting
round. As did Stacey Evans,
As did Stacey
right?
Evans, who has much less of a national following. And so I think the Stacey Evans campaign was expecting Stacey Abrams to pull away. We'll see if it happens now.
All right. What other disclosures are you particularly looking forward to in other races?
Yeah, I mean, I'll look all the way down the ballot. The state legislative races are going to be really interesting, because we talked about resignations in Congress all over the nation for Republicans in competitive districts. It's happening right here as well. There's about a dozen Republicans in suburban, conservative-leaning districts, some who had rarely been challenged, if ever, who are now settling in these very purple districts. And a lot of them have already either said they're not running for another term or are running for other office. So these seats are open, and there's Democratic challengers going after them.
We literally have about a minute and a half, so I want to do rapid fire here. A couple of interesting bills, Greg, I'll start with you, introduced in the legislature this week. One is going to place an additional restriction on young women who want to have abortions without parental consent. There was only like 42 applications by young women to do this to go to a judge without parental consent and say they need an abortion. But any effort to in any way curtail abortions is looked at with either great excitement or anger. So it's an issue.
This is a volatile one, and it's election year, and I doubt this will go very far, but you'll see a lot of these proposals, same thing with English-only bill, that really might not go anywhere but get a lot of conversation and give candidates campaign fodder on the trail.
Yeah, well, I think that's that bill in particular is a message issue.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we all recognize it as such. It's a fundraising issue. There's not a lot of data out there to show that there is a problem that needs to be solved other than just the larger tragedy that's going on there. But it's just a political message bill at this
point. We have plenty of time to talk about the legislature on Political Rewind in the weeks ahead, and of course we will do that. We're out of time for our show today. First, our thanks to you, Mayor Ray Martinez of Loganville. It's great
Thank
to have you.
You
on for the first time. Did you like being here?
I loved it.
You've got to say that, don't you?
Look forward to coming back.
Patricia Murphy, Roll Call, Daily Beast, Garden and Gun. We know we love having you here. Bluestein, what's the big headline from you tomorrow, probably?
We're going to write about Republicans who feel betrayed by Trump's immigration stance.
All right. We'll watch for that in tomorrow's AJC. A couple quick notes. Number one, next Thursday, a week from Thursday, February 8th, we'll be in Savannah doing the show in front of a live audience. Jim Galloway's coming down with me. For that show, we're going to be, we've been hosted by the League of Women Voters of Coastal Georgia, 7 o'clock next Thursday night. There is still room for you to be in the audience. It doesn't cost anything, but you need to register. Go to gpb.org/community for all the information you need about that event. Tomorrow on Two-Way Street, a really fascinating conversation on the Gullah people of Sapelo Island. There may be a lot of misinformation and misunderstandings about who they really are, and we'll talk about that. And then Friday, Senator Johnny Isaacson comes back for one of his visits to our studios. You think we'll have anything to talk with him about? I'll bet we'll find something. That's it for us today. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again tomorrow at 2 for Two-Way Street, and Friday at 2 for Political Rewind.